Hello, podcast listeners. We know podcasts are a great way to catch up on a program that you may have missed on KSJE, and it's provided as a free service of this radio station. But you know, KSJE is now listener-supported, and so while you enjoy this podcast, we hope that you'll also take some time to join KSJE. Become a member today. It's quite easy to do. Just go to our website at ksje.com/support and pick the level of support that best matches your budget. Thanks again for listening. Here's your podcast.
Good morning, everyone. I'm Megan Cullop, along here with Scott Micklin.
Good morning. It is Monday, October 19th, week number...
32.
32.
I think.
You're right.
Yeah.
I'm pretty sure you're right.
Okay.
I double-checked this morning before.
Did you?
Yeah. We didn't get our calendar lady... post or message, but I'm pretty sure it's 32.
Slacking.
And if we're not, if it's not right, she will correct us.
She will.
She will. She has no qualms.
No.
About correcting us.
Which is awesome.
We appreciate that.
We love that.
We need correcting.
We do.
Probably more than just the calendar.
For sure.
Yeah. But anyways, welcome everybody. We're glad that you are with us on this Monday. It is our COVID-19 community information program, and we've got a great program lined up. In fact, we have a guest already ready to go.
Let's go to the phones.
Go to the phones right now. Dr. Eugene Schmidt, Superintendent of Schools with the Farmington School District, is joining us this morning. Dr. Schmidt, good morning.
Good morning, Scott and Megan. And let me share that even as the two of you are debating what week of the year it is the start of frost season week.
That is very true. We can certainly tell the weather is taking a decided turn colder. And so hopefully, I know you've got a beautiful garden at your home, Dr. Schmidt, and so hopefully you're taking precautions to protect those plants.
Yes, the potato vines took a beating over the weekend.
That will happen, but you're right. So this is the 32nd week of the program, right, of our restrictions. That's what we're counting, right?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay.
So we've been on quite a number of times. So
yeah.
Forgive us if we start talking crazy.
Well, that happens every week,
That's
afraid. Not just 32, week 32. But Dr. Schmidt, we wanted to have you on because Farmington Schools, of course, welcomed back students to some face-to-face learning for the first time in probably about 32 weeks. And so we wanted to get an update from you as the biggest school district in our listening area, how things are going now as you enter your second week of face-to-face classes for some of your students and staff.
And Scott, thank you for that, because literally we go back to March 13th when we got the call out that things would be shut down on the following Monday. So it's been a long time since we have seen these numbers of kids, over 2,200, started a hybrid return to learn last Tuesday. And it was really a fingers crossed kind of thing, Scott and Megan, because, you know, we're watching the COVID positivity rate climb back up. And we heard the governor to say things like, if your school hasn't opened yet, you know, and the rates go up, you know, you might not get to open. So we're saying fast forward the calendar, you know, get us to last Tuesday. And so we were very excited to open the doors. And I can talk about the five schools that I've already visited, but people are so happy to be back to school. It just makes me feel good.
Yeah, I bet. And so what grades have returned so far?
And then that's a great question, Megan. So I'm going to break it into two different groups. The first group I'm going to call a jump start, families of special need kids, K through 12, will know that they're going to say, hey, our kids have been back almost a month. Yeah, we've had probably 200 of our most needy special ed kids in groups of one-on-one with a teacher up to maybe 1 to 4. That we've been granted special permission to bring our most needy kids back. So I'm gonna say good for those kids. But now we open the doors for an expanded number of preschool up through fifth grade. And so we have two different models that if I can delve into wonkiness of school, we have two different models. One is a hybrid model where some entire schools and some grade levels at other schools, and I'll try and separate the two, are back in an in-person learning Tuesday through Friday with a Monday at home. So schools like Apache, McCormick, McKinley, Animas, Esperanza are amongst the schools that we had a population that we were able to bring back the entire school that wanted to come back. In contrast, Country Club, Ladera, Mesa Verde are three examples where we had to meet a state condition to come back, and that condition was, of course, social distance. I know that you and Scott are doing that this morning, but social distance is one, but also not more than 50% of a school slash teacher roster. For example, Country Club, let's use easy numbers, 500 kids are on their enrollment. 250 chose to stay at home, and 250 chose to return to learn. To do that, we had to make sure that we also conformed to the classroom spacing and the teacher. So in some cases, all the kids that wanted to come back, for example, kindergarten and first grade, but third grade, we had to go on an AB, which is a Tuesday, Wednesday, and then Thursday, Friday, because more kids in that grade level wanted to come back than the 50%. So two different kinds of models, a hybrid of 4 days a week or a hybrid of 2 days a week, but everybody has some time at home doing the virtual learning. Whatever model it is, kids are happy to be back.
Yeah, I can believe that. And so in between days, do you have like some sort of crazy intense cleaning protocol? Is that part of the decision? Is giving that surface virus time to dissipate?
Yes, and Megan, I thank you for that. We literally have that deep clean that you're describing daily. You know, there's a lot of practice of the hand washing, mask wearing, temperature check by parents. And so, yeah, the deep clean literally happens every day for those schools where kids come back daily. I do want to give a shout out because you've given me this opportunity. We have what we call a Ruvna app. There's a phone app that parents can do the pre-screening of kids. And that pre-screening is take a temperature check. You know, have you been out of state? Have you been in contact with anybody that may have been infected? Do you have a temperature today? Do you have a runny nose? Any number of 1 to 8 different kinds of symptoms. And if you respond yes to those, you know, yes, my temperature is higher than 99.9, the little phone app says, probably a good day to stay home. And so what excites me, Megan, is that on day one, 87% of 2,200 parents did the Ruvna app. And so we know that it's been pushed out into the town. And for those families that don't, you know, we do the check at the school as you walk in the door. In fact, of the schools that I visited, I also got my temperature checked. But we do practice really safe practices. And I know it's just week one, 4 days in, but we haven't found a confirmed case amongst those kids. Now, we have had staff and we've had virtual kids that have been reported as positive. And so we as a district are trying to be very transparent. Every time a staff member or a student, you know, is reported to Public Education Department, becomes part of the New Mexico Department of Health report that goes back to all schools across the state. But so far it looks like Farmington kids and parents are behaving, and I thank them for that.
That's very good, Dr. Schmidt. And I know I was just going to point out the transparency from the district about these positive cases, and I think you're to be commended for sharing that with the community. And I know you have a plan in place, as all school districts do that have reopened, to deal with these cases as they come in, whether it's a virtual learner or, if could happen, as has happened in other cases, a student who is actually in your building that may be positive, correct?
Yes, and we actually do. So I'm going to respond to this in two parts. And because I know that we talked about this back in March, and I said, Scott, we don't know what this is. If I have a single case, I'm shutting down the whole district. Well, we've learned a lot since March 13th. And now it's you know, through contact tracing, through good communication with parents. It's literally, we're going to try and identify the kid, and then was the kid or the staff member close to anybody that may or may not have been infected, and then we ask a small group to quarantine and then follow that just stay-at-home protocol. So the first thing is, can we identify the person? Who was that person in contact? So just that immediate group of one, two, or three. And then we look at, okay, it was inside the school in the classroom, but the classroom didn't go anywhere. So that class would be asked to stay home and quarantine and test. Or in the case of Rio Rancho that you might have seen the news this morning, at one school in Rio Rancho, they sent the whole grade level home. And so you go from the person to the classroom, maybe to the wing of the building, maybe the entire building. So we have different layers that, depending upon how much mobility took place, that others may or may not been impacted by the suspected corona case.
Understood. And Dr. Schmidt, I imagine that explanation kind of talks a little bit, too, about the complications of bringing back your older students, because, again, these younger kids through grade 5 are really with their own cohort, if you will, in their class every day, and so they're not mingling or switching classes, whereas maybe your junior high and high school students would be maybe going into other classes for their with other teachers, and that kind of mingles and makes contact tracing, if there is a case, all that more complicated. Is that part of the concern, I guess, with the public education department?
Yeah, so again, I'm going to answer that in two different parts, because even though we try to keep these grade school kids in cohorts, I'll call them pods or little families, they're also intermingling on the bus. And so we have a bus cohort, and you have a grade band cohort. And, you know, if they are too widely spread on the playground, we may have a playground set. And so we are trying to understand and minimize the movement. For example, on a bus, you know, big kids to the back, little kids to the front, you know, maybe family units sit together or close together on the bus. So a number of different practices, but your question about the middle and high school is really a good one, because kids go from the English teacher to the math teacher to the music teacher. Maybe they go then back to the science lab. You know, potentially there would be a lot of movement in the hall. And so there's a lot of conversations going on internally, because we've told the public education department, we've shared our thoughts with the governor's office, that if I can bring back 12 groups or different buildings of pre-K through 5, I ought to be able to bring back 4 middle school groups. If, as you suggest, I can figure out a way to cohort those bunches. And while we have not submitted our plan to the state, might we move teachers more than kids as a way of getting some permission from the public education department? Or might we look at a different way to release kids? So I'm going to use Heights Middle School, 700 kids. We hope to bring back 350. What if you staggered when those kids, just only sixth graders can be released, or seventh or eighth, as a way of minimizing whatever activity or interaction there may be in the hall? So there's ways to do that. We just have to have time to sit down and say, okay, when you're in the hall, you're only on the right side of the hall. You can't be on the left. Nobody uses a locker. Everybody carries their things what they can, you know, from class to class if we move. So there are ways to do this. And we would like Farmington to be the first school chosen to try.
That makes sense. And I have a question about teachers. Obviously, the younger the person is that catches COVID, the better outcomes they have. That's, of course, the generalization and not true across the board, but for the most part. And so I know quite a number of older teachers have had concerns about going back. And so has there been some sort of shift in...
Let me just say, we prefer to be called seasoned teachers, Megan.
You're not... whatever, Scott. Okay. Seasoned individuals.
Thank you.
Has there been some shuffling around that maybe the more seasoned individuals teach remotely and then, you know, people who are more comfortable are the ones in the classroom, something like that?
So I do appreciate that. And we do try and follow the science. We do try and understand what is the, you know, other schools across the nation have opened before us. And so we again try to understand what may or may not be the medical impact to the, you know, the what I would call those groups that science identifies. So to answer your question, Megan, and I appreciate you asking, and that we have given staff an opportunity who feel that they are most at risk to be virtual teachers. And so I think in initial we had something like 30 plus people that identified themselves as preferring to be virtual teachers. It may be up as high as 50 now, but people were given an option and an opportunity to explain why they would prefer teaching in one environment versus another. And as you say, right now, I probably have 740 teachers, and I'm guessing over 400 are virtual right now. Again, because middle and high can't come back, but of that population, probably 50, if given the choice, would prefer to stay virtual.
Understood. And Dr. Schmidt, we just have a couple of minutes remaining with you this morning, so I think our final question would be just a reminder to folks who are listening or watching this morning of the other services available. I know some students are having maybe more difficulties or challenges learning virtually and not being able to come back to school. And so I know the district provides counseling services and things like that if families feel that they are in need of that. That's another thing that folks should take advantage of if they feel that's necessary, correct?
Yeah, and Scott, I think that's really a kind way to end this segment, as we are concerned about the social, emotional, behavioral health of kids and teachers. And so if you have concerns, we do have counselors, social workers standing by to, you know, to take your calls. And perhaps maybe, Megan, I would love to have an invite back. Just have that as a theme for one of your Monday shows.
We will do that, Dr. Schmidt. But for now, we will let you get back to the important work that you are doing with our schools and the students in your care. So thank you very much for joining us this morning.
Thank you. And have a great weekend. And we're glad to have our kids back in school.
Indeed. Thank you very much, Dr. Eugene Schmidt, Superintendent of Schools with the Farmington School District, and I'll be talking with Dr. Schmidt actually next Wednesday at 8 on my program, a little bit longer conversation with him. So we invite folks to join us for that as
Good.
Well. So there you go. We appreciate that very much, and let's go to our next guest, who is also on the line this morning, and this is Jeff Bourgeois from Salem Regional Medical Center, if I'm guessing correctly. Good morning. You're on KSJE.
Good morning, Scott. Good guess. It's me.
There he is. No one lights up the phone like you, Jeff Bourgeois. That's what I'll say.
Yeah, right.
So we appreciate you coming back on, Jeff Bourgeois, because we wanted to just to double check with you, because we've seen this big influx of COVID cases around our state. And so, you know, the question was, is that impacting San Juan Regional Medical Center? Even San Juan County's cases have been higher than we've seen, and we're hoping that the numbers are still manageable there at the hospital, so we thought we'd ask you directly. So what can you tell us?
Very good. Well, good morning, Scott and Megan. The case count in our state certainly is on the uptick. While we've seen a small increase in the rolling 14-day average positivity rate, we are still less than 4% as of today. On the inpatient side, we only have 3 positive COVID patients in-house. None of those are intubated. We have 11 additional patients who are pending test results. So very, very manageable from an inpatient status perspective for our teams here. I was just looking back at some historical numbers. You know, we hit our peak in terms of that rolling 14-day positivity rate back in mid-May, just under 16%. It fell off to well less than 10% by the end of June, and then we had a little bump around the second week of July back up to about 12.5% or so. Then it fell sharply to less than 2% mid-September. So it is back up a little bit off our low, but still far from the peaks we saw earlier. And again, today sitting at less than 4% overall positivity rate on a rolling 14-day average. So what I'm seeing is that other parts of the state, particularly the population center of our state, Albuquerque, and then the southeast region closer to West Texas seems to have a pretty high case count going on. So we're fortunate that while we've seen a small increase here, we haven't seen that kind of impact on our inpatient units.
Very good. And I have a question. We haven't asked you about visitor policy in quite some time. Can you give us a rundown on what the visitor policy is these days?
I'll be happy to. And I also want to remind the public to always go to our website, right, to look at what's there. We still have a very a different visitor policy in place now than we do in a non-pandemic state. So I just want to remind everybody of that. You know, we still screen people upon entrance to the hospital. I'm looking for something. We're still restricting visitors in general due to the COVID safe practices that are in place. So,
and now you imagine all that, Jeff Bourgeois, yeah. on your website, if folks can check it before coming to visit a patient or double checking before they come to the hospital.
Right. So I'm navigating itself right now that the COVID 19 information piece is still up, and you'll be able to find the details there.
Okay.
We do encourage, you know, virtual visits whenever possible. And we certainly acknowledge it is far less than ideal to have a family member or loved one there with a patient. We believe it's part of the healing process, and we are anxious to get back to a more normal visitor policy. And unfortunately, we just can't do that yet.
Understood. Well, we appreciate the update, Jeff Bourgeois. Before we let you go, I just want to ask you for a plug on flu shots. I know the hospital is starting up some drive-through flu clinics. Of course, vaccines are being made available throughout the community. But that's really important this year because of COVID and some of the other, I guess, complications and other issues. We don't want to overwhelm our hospitals with flu patients and COVID patients, for heaven's sakes, right?
Right. So this Saturday, October 24th, and the following Saturday, October 31st, we'll do our community flu drives. It'll be 9 a.m. to noon both days. It'll be at the corner of Maple and Schwartz on the hospital campus. And we'll go till noon or until supplies run out. We ask that, again, on our website there's some instruction there, but wear a short sleeve shirt or roll your sleeve up ahead of time. You will need to wear a mask, and if we encourage people that if they have any COVID-19-like symptoms, such as a sore throat, cough, body aches, fever, or respiratory symptoms, that they wait to get their flu vaccine until those symptoms have passed. These flu shots are free, and they are available on a first-come, first-served basis for adults ages 18 and older.
Very good. Well, and again, it's so important to do that this year, beyond the other years too, but obviously it's important this year. So thank you, Jeff Bourgeois, very much.
Thank you all, and y'all have a wonderful week.
You too.
All right, you too. Thank you very much. That's Jeff Bourgeois, the president and CEO of San Juan Regional Medical Center, with us this morning, and we appreciate his comments always, but good to know that San Juan County's numbers are still manageable. And
yeah.
The hospital's not being overwhelmed.
Yep. Because like in Wisconsin, they had to set up field hospitals.
Right.
So.
And we remember some of that. They were preparing for that here back during our peak.
They were up in near the National Guard. area.
Near the airport. That's right. So anyway, we're so grateful we didn't have to do that, and hopefully still won't have to do that. Mm-hmm. So that's important. But anyway, so we appreciate both of our guests calling in this morning. We can talk a little bit about the numbers, and I know you had you have another story to share, too, before we go today. So let's take a look, everybody, as far as testing dates this week. Again, here at the college, it happened this morning. It'll be back at the college this afternoon from 4:30 to 6 p.m. COVID testing. And then Wednesday, October 21st in the morning from 7:30 a.m. to 9 a.m. And then Friday this week, October 23rd from 7:30 a.m. to 9 a.m. All locations are here at San Juan College. You can follow the signs on campus, but the testing site is located in front of the Henderson Fine Arts Center. So if you're familiar with the college, that's where you're going to be going for the COVID-19 testing this week. Of course, the health department always asks that you register ahead of time, and you can call 505-327-4461, 327-4461 if you need assistance to get registered for your COVID test. And then, of course, we always like to check in with our friends at Johns Hopkins. What?
Our friends.
Don't we have friends at Johns Hopkins?
We do.
Okay. So there you go. For their numbers, because they've been tracking this since the beginning, 32 weeks plus.
Yes.
And so how do things look?
So we have 8,157,704 confirmed cases in the United States. I had heard from Bloomberg News that we had a day over the weekend where we had 70,000 new cases in one day.
That sounds like a record.
Pretty
close to a record.
Pretty close.
Yeah.
Pretty close.
If it's not. Okay.
And we have 219,706 confirmed deaths in the United States.
Wow. And I keep going back to that 200,000 number because we marked it because, again, the media does those types of things. But this is 10% increase now in just what? I don't know. Two weeks? 3 weeks?
Yeah, 3 weeks.
You know? So that's maybe a concern. And again, we can see the graph in the lower right-hand part of the screen there of how the cases are trending, at least back up at the moment across the country. Mm-hmm. So there you go. If we look at the other numbers this morning from New Mexico, these numbers are still higher than we have seen, but lower than they were late last week when we were in the 500 cases a day. 448 new cases reported on Sunday, for a total now of 36,788 cases in New Mexico. 8 of those were in San Juan County. Again, that's lower. We were in the double digits there for a while, low 20s, mid-20s per day, a couple of days last week in San Juan County. So we're back in the single digits, I think, which is encouraging. 5 deaths in our state on Sunday reported for a total now of 934, and 0 of those were from San Juan County. There were 41 additional recoveries. There was a big increase over the weekend, too, and we're now at 19,894 recoveries in our state. So we always like to report that as well. So that's good to report. And as we take a look at the other page from KSJE.com, the Navajo Nation cases, again, they were at 42 yesterday on Sunday. It was noted, I believe, on Saturday that the Navajo Nation reported cases above 50, and that was the first time the number was above 50 for several weeks on the Navajo Nation. 2 additional deaths reported now, so a total case number on the Navajo Nation of 10,955, and the number of deaths now at 573, and that they have 7,381 recoveries.
Yeah.
On the Navajo
Nation. And this is just really, I've just been really interested in this case number rise we have going on, this second surge. We're actually not the only country that's seeing a second surge. Western European countries are joining us in that. Great Britain, namely, is joining us in that. And I don't know if it's, are we getting less vigilant? What is happening? At least in our part of the world, it's not really cold enough yet to be restricting ourselves to indoors, but
true. But I think that's why we're seeing maybe in some of the other states that things are getting colder, and so we're seeing some of the outbreaks. Yeah. Wisconsin, there you go. Yeah. I don't know. And as Mr. Bourgeois said, in the southeast part of New Mexico, which would be the Roswell, I think more in towards the Hobbs, New Mexico area, Albuquerque, we see a big influx of cases, and maybe Las Cruces, I think, has had a little bit of a surge. And I don't know if we actually know some of those reasons why, if the contact tracing has kind of identified how that's happening. Some people were saying maybe for Las Cruces, there was a lot of maybe spread from El Paso, which of course is just down the road, and they've had a lot of cases in Texas.
Right.
So there's all that speculation. But
yes.
Anyway, but we'll keep watching it. And again, we hope that San Juan County keeps doing what San Juan County needs to do, which is to keep our numbers Where they've been, and even lower would be preferable, obviously.
Sure.
So
as low as we can go.
That's right.
It's like a weird limbo.
Yes. Hashtag 2020.
Yeah.
So you had another story to share with us. I think that's all we had to share today, by the way. Everyone, let me double check and see. Yep, that was all.
Yes.
That's all I had on my sleeve.
Cool. So a country. Jeez. Okay. Kentucky Bioprocessing in the southeastern, of course, part of the United States is working on a vaccine using the tobacco plant, right?
Really?
Which obviously has this more notorious reputation for contributing to various illnesses. But alas, it's still, as Kentucky Bioprocessing said, really at the end of the day, it is just a plant, right? And so they are biochemically engineering that plant to produce proteins from coronavirus. When you have this protein, you can inject it, and it is a semblance of the virus that essentially tricks the immune system into thinking that it is the virus, but it is not infectious like the real virus would be, right? So the wonders of science. So the tobacco plant vaccine is currently in trials, actually. And of course, when it comes to a race for vaccines, there's a lot of other considerations. You might have something that works, but is it something that works in three injections, like the varicella vaccine?
Right. Okay.
Chickenpox requires two, for example.
Right, which you need to get an initial vaccine, then maybe a booster
down the road
or something, right?
Yeah.
I got it.
So, you know, that's a consideration because it's a lot harder to get people to come back to complete the series. It's kind of like when folks don't want to complete antibiotics or something. It's just hard to keep people motivated to do what they're supposed to do. Also, this tobacco vaccine can be stored at room temperature, which is not the same across the board. Many vaccines have to be refrigerated, and so it's a lot harder to store them. So,
or transport them, too,
or transport
think,
right? them. Mm-hmm. So I just found that fascinating.
That is interesting.
Hats off to the tobacco plant.
Right.
The lowly tobacco processing.
And who knew?
Yes.
But that's just one of, I guess, a number of companies working on a vaccine, right?
Yes.
And so we're kind of just waiting to see which trials work out best. We've heard some trials are stopping or slowing down because of some adverse reactions.
Limited adverse reactions, but yeah.
What have you. So, you know, I know a lot of folks are still very hopeful for a successful trial and vaccine here in the next few months.
Yes, and as Dr. Greenberg is always reminding us, this is science doing its thing. So when you stop the vaccine trial, this is just doing what we're supposed to do. This is the system that's been set up. So
very true. And trying it with different things like tobacco, apparently.
I mean, Kentucky has a slew of it. So
they do.
You might as well, if you're going to pick a plant.
I guess.
Let's pick that.
Why not geraniums? I don't know.
I mean...
But okay,
because
that's why I'm not a scientist.
I don't know. Maybe they're trying to redeem the tobacco plant.
Maybe they are.
I'm a fan of a good redemption story.
Unique in tobacco that is helpful, obviously.
Yeah. Well, exactly. I don't know. They didn't really spell out the full science of this at the National Public Radio story for the lay person, but it could just be that it's easier to buy.
Well, you mentioned it was manipulated.
It is. It's manipulated.
And so that may be why.
Mm-hmm.
So there you go. Okay.
Yeah.
Thanks for bringing that to the show.
You're welcome.
Very interesting.
You're welcome.
So there you are. I think that's all we have for today to share with everybody, week 32, as we get going. But we'll be back on Thursday, everybody. We've got some great guests lined up for Thursday's program. And again, we're always updating KSJE.com/news with the latest numbers from the state, from the tribe, and any other COVID-related stories that come up during the week. So we invite you to check that out as well. But we'll be back on Thursday. Stay safe and stay well. And have a great Monday, everybody. This is KSJE. Did you enjoy that podcast? We hope that you did. And if you did, share it with your friends. And if you really want to keep podcasts like this coming, please support KSJE. You can do it easily online at ksje.com.